This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Policing in Phoenix has been a major issue, particularly over the last week or so when things got to a boil in the Phoenix City Council. There was a vote to establish a citizen review commission, and a lot of contention about it. It was a 5-4 vote. The end vote was a little bit of a surprise because there were a couple of different proposals on the ballot before the council. And that's what we're going to discuss here. We have two folks here who were involved in various levels in this. Sam Stone is a chief of staff to Phoenix Councilman Sal DeCiccio, who would have been here but for medical reasons. Fortunately, he says he can speak for Sam, and we will ask him to do so.
As close as anyone ever can.
Oh, okay. Two peas in a pod. Okay, very good here. He's also been a political consultant and run campaigns and stuff in the state. Julie Erfley has been a television producer at Channels 3 and 5, a political advocate, and a communications consultant at her own firm, Erfley & Cuff. She also writes a column for the Arizona Mirror. And I'd add that on the top of policing, she speaks with a unique moral authority. Her husband was a Phoenix police officer killed in the line of duty. Let's establish, if we could, as without editorial comment, just what happened in Phoenix. Sam, you're working closely with the council. What was the sequence of events that brought this matter to a vote, and what were we voting on?
Mike, this has been coming for really 2+ years now. We had a very bad year with police shootings in 2018 in Phoenix, where we had 44 of them, which is, you know, a near doubling of a kind of normal number for what we've seen here historically. And that really drove and combined with the national narrative that has been going on in inner city communities across the country. You had Carlos Garcia, now Councilman Garcia, and his groups, Poder in Action and Puente, both really start putting a lot of pressure on starting a couple of years ago for the council. And last week was the culmination of their efforts.
Okay. Julie, there were two proposals that before, and I know you've been down in the weeds on this. There are two separate proposals. Could you describe what each one of those was?
Sure. The first one that was put forward that was championed by the mayor was basically an auditor model. And it was modeled mainly after what they have currently in Denver, Colorado, which is you have this separate office that has an auditor that essentially watches investigations as they happen, audits past investigations, looks for trends. The office also has data analysis, people who are looking at policy, community outreach specialists. And then there's a separate community relations board that is civilians who are taking complaints from the community and really, you know, having that dialogue back and forth with the community. That was the model that the mayor had championed.
And we'll call it the auditor model or the mayor's plan if we wish. Okay.
That's perfect. The second model, which was the one that Councilman Garcia championed, was an investigative model. This model, because of our own charter, could not go quite as far as a lot of investigative models go. So, for instance, there is no subpoena power. I know that that's something that they would have liked, but there is no subpoena power.
That constrains what an investigation can do.
Correct. So they now, what this model is intending to do, it remains to see how it's implemented. But essentially, it would create, again, this independent office, just like in the other one. But there would be investigators who would be involved every step of the way doing essentially their own investigation and asking questions as well during these processes, coming up with their own conclusion on discipline, and then presenting that to the chief as well.
Does that preempt or is that in addition to the internal investigation of the police department?
It runs parallel. And at the end of the day,
in addition.
Correct. Correct. So at the end of the day, it's still up to the chief of police.
So the chief would get two sets of findings, one from this independent group and one from internal affairs.
Correct.
And the chief would have to weigh those and whatever other considerations there are, make a call.
Correct.
None of these plans alter the fact that the police chief is the final arbiter, is that correct?
No, and they really cannot. That would have required a change in our city charter. That would have required a vote.
Okay.
So
and
both of these.
That in turn would have been a political mess.
Correct.
I mean, that would have been World War III over
right.
here. Fair statement of facts here?
Yeah, absolutely it is. I think the biggest concern that we see is the politicizing of these decisions, which has been happening more frequently lately. And so the dual track, I think it's a mistake to think that whatever recommendation IAB, our Internal Affairs Bureau, comes up with, if that's significantly different in any way from the recommendation that this board comes up with, I think it's foolish to think that a chief could then choose to follow IAB's recommendations and still keep their job over any length of time.
IAB being internal.
Internal affairs.
Because of the politics of the police department.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically.
I think, and that brings a whole new element to how we're operating our police department that we're very uncomfortable
Before we
with.
Get further down the road on that, could you pick this up? Because you're right at the council. The sequence of events, because you may have the mayor with the sort of the auditor proposal, but for those who weren't or didn't follow it, it was the other proposal.
Yeah, I mean,
the investigative proposal. There was that proposal that won. What was the sequence of events that led to that?
I got to tell you, Mike, in terms of political maneuvering, that was one of the greatest coup d'etats that I have seen in local politics anywhere at any time. And Carlos Garcia, along with the other new councilwoman, Betty Guardado, really did a great job in putting that together. The mayor had a plan that she had developed and worked with. And even though PLEA and the police union, and our office and some of the others weren't entirely comfortable with her proposal, it was something that I think everyone would have been pretty happy living with.
And what was that proposal?
That was the initial proposal, which is the auditor model.
Okay, the auditor. Okay.
The mayor's proposal, the auditor model. And the mayor has the agendizing or scheduling power for city council meetings. Mm-hmm. Council members can only put their own items on by having three council members sign off on it. Councilman Garcia convinced the mayor on her own hook to put his proposal forward, and then filled the room with his supporters, who were viciously attacking the mayor throughout about 6 hours of testimony for putting her proposal forward in the first place, and demanding Carlos's model be adopted. And the mayor found herself, she took it on the chin. I mean, whatever else comes out of this, if I were her, I would be terrified of Carlos if he decides to run for mayor. He's going to beat her in a primary.
By the way, just for the record, we invited Carlos to be here. We also tried to reach some people from Poder. They would have a seat at this table.
Mm-hmm.
We could not connect with them. I don't know that. I don't know that they rejected it, but we had trouble. We never got a response. I don't know what happened. So.
You know, I am incredibly impressed with Councilman Garcia's work on this issue and his political instincts. That it's difficult to get his attention on other things at times, is what I've seen.
Regardless. Anyway, so the sequence was, so basically Councilman Garcia got through public pressure, got his proposal up on the agenda.
Yeah, the mayor could have avoided a lot of pain for herself if she had managed to keep his proposal off the agenda.
Then her more moderate proposal probably would have won 5-4. Would it have picked up any support?
6-3, maybe 7-2, even. I think
There's
a very good chance that her proposal would have gotten. We know it had Deb Stark, so that would have been the sixth vote, Councilwoman Stark. I think there's a good chance that it would have gotten Councilwoman Williams.
Okay, interesting.
So it was a much different, very different proposals in the way they work.
Okay. that's the story of what happened. We're going to argue about the wisdom of it and various models and other implications when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking about policing in Arizona and specifically the police review proposal that just passed the Phoenix City Council. Sam Stone is, among other things, a chief of staff for Sal DeCiccio, who's both of you guys have been here at various points in time, but you're his alter ego.
I am his alter ego, or, you know, as I always say around City Hall, I'm the Grim Reaper's minion.
Well, and you are, your side's basically opposed to this. We did try to get people, the chief proponents here, for whatever reason, we did not succeed. The group Potter in Arizona and Carlos Garcia, the councilman who pushed it the most. Julie Earfley is probably in the middle on this issue, at least from the Arizona Mirror editorial that I read. So I want to ask a couple of questions of you, Sam, that might kind of reflect the seat that's missing at this table.
Please.
And ask you some of the stuff that comes up in terms of the way people describe it. Do you think there's a war on police?
No, I don't think there is a war on police.
Because we do hear that, you know.
Yeah.
You hear that?
I think, like a lot of things, there is an absolutism and an exaggeration in modern media and modern communications that comes across in every aspect of what we keep talking about these days. I don't think it's a war on police, but I do think there is a breakdown that is going on in terms of the interactions between police and their communities. And I have a hard time, from my perspective, seeing that being on the police's end, simply because it hasn't changed. I mean, they're not suddenly doing things in low-income or minority communities that they haven't been for 20 or 30 years. There's been a much better relationship in the past with leaders in those communities and our police department here in Phoenix and around the country. And that's really gone away. And I think a lot of it is politically driven rather than reality driven in a certain sense. You had one of Potter in Action's leaders was quoted in the Phoenix New Times about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, saying, I grew up with a school resource officer at our schools, and I really liked them. I thought they were great. But then I got involved with this organization, and they told me how they're killing and oppressing my people. Mm-hmm. And now I'm out here calling them all sorts of names.
And you think it's ideologically driven?
Yeah, I do. Right. I think the basis of it is ideologically driven.
Okay.
And I have a real hard time understanding why people would do that. Law and order is the foundation for any society. Mm-hmm. And I can't point in the entirety of history to a single society that has uplifted its poorest and most vulnerable citizens without that strong basis of the rule of law.
An anecdote from many, many years ago, I knew a professor at Wayne State. This is after the 1968 racial riots. In which the police played, you know, a part, and there was great contention between this is Detroit, between the police and the community. And she did a survey of the community, poor communities of those neighborhoods where they rioted. And you know what the number one complaint about the police was back then? They don't come when you call.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, not that there aren't real points of contention, but those points of contention are rarely the life-changing ones that being infested with crime.
Yeah. You know, I mean, interestingly, I think a lot of people forget the history of policing in inner city communities and the fact that you had a major pullback. And the issue was they weren't coming when they were called in the 70s and the early 80s. And those communities really cried out for much more policing. If you look at the origins of Rudy Giuliani's broken windows policing strategy in New York City that led to stop and frisk and all these things that are considered just egregious these days, it was those calls for that type of policing enforcement in low-income and minority communities for them to really get serious about getting the crime off the street.
Well, let me ask another question, though. Police shootings. They're up by a bunch. Do we have a problem here?
Well, they were up for 1 year by a bunch. Because, you know, you look last year, we had 15 of them, which is the average is around 24, 25 per year throughout the last decade. So you had 2018 at 44, then you had 2019 at 15. And so far this year, we've had one incident where an officer discharged their weapon at a citizen. Mm. They didn't actually hit him.
But question, is it regardless, we could quibble over the number of the statistic, but well, is there a problem?
But when you say it's up.
Okay. Fair. I'm just saying, is there a problem?
No. I mean, look, we look at every one of these cases. Every time there's a shooting, our office digs into it in depth and follows that case through its conclusion. Of the 44, we felt that two were egregious, and there were should have been consequences for that.
Okay. We'll pick this up, and when we return, I'll ask the kind of the core question, which is, can the police police themselves, or is that inherently an undoable contract? That's, kind of, to me, the essence of what this whole issue is about. We'll return in the think tank after the break with that as the lead question.
Rise, the morning lights, the streets that lead them, and sirens call them on with a song.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back discussing policing in Phoenix, and if you just came on board, our guest, our Sam Stone, he is, among other things, Chief of Staff for Councilman Sal DeCiccio. Julie Earfley is a former television producer, communications expert, and on point in terms of policing, the widow of a police officer killed in duty some years ago. The lead question, I want to go to you first on this, Julie. I think this is the philosophical basis of this whole issue. Can the police themselves?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the argument goes, well, we're the only one who really understands. If you're not, if you haven't been out on the street and you don't know what, don't put up with what we put up with and see what right. we see, then you can't possibly render an appropriate judgment about the appropriateness of our activities.
Right. Well, I would say first and foremost, they aren't the only ones policing themselves. Mm-hmm. You do have the county attorney's office as well that looks at all of these investigations. So the idea that they're doing this completely in a bubble is not correct. And we also do have some civilians that sit on the discipline review board. Mm-hmm. Can there be, can there be more civilian oversight? Yes.
If I just interrupt for just a second and let you return. The argument about is that the county attorney, they have to work with the police on an everyday basis, mm-hmm. and that there's kind of a conflict. It's unreasonable to expect them to be completely independent when their success is dependent on good relationships with the police.
Yeah, I would say the community's success is dependent on, I mean, we're all dependent on good relationships with each other. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a
very intimate one. On a day-to-day basis, right. police officers bring evidence and people to the county attorney to prosecute. Neither can do their job very well without the cooperation of the other.
Right. And you certainly have county attorney's offices who are more cooperative or independent, depending on the county attorney. I mean, I'm definitely not going to deny that fact. But again, I think that there is a role for civilians to play in all of this. But we also have to understand that there are also other things that we have to keep in mind when it comes to civilian oversight that I think the city, and in particular the council and the city manager's office, hasn't done a very good job of explaining to the public. There are charter rules that we have to abide. There are agreements with the unions that we have to abide by. There are civil servant laws that we must abide by. And I don't think that the community necessarily understands all of that. And so that may be where some of the tension lies. But certainly we can do a much better job of being transparent. And by the way, I have to say, we're already moving in that direction. Again, I don't know that the community really understands this because I don't think there has been a very good PR campaign to advertise what has changed and what is in the process of changing with the Phoenix Police Department. But it's pretty major. It's not just police body cameras. It's also tracking, pointing guns at people, which is something that's very new. They've only been doing for a few months. It's also that they're in the process of creating a crisis response, or the Sam, help me with the name of it.
The final name hasn't been picked yet, but a mental health crisis response team.
Correct.
That would be a non-police team, but with some basic police training for self-protection, but that takes some of that law enforcement out of the initial contact. It's a little bit like the Eugene, Oregon model.
Right.
You're talking about when you get a case and you go there, and it's obviously you're dealing with somebody who's not right.
Or someone tells us in the 911 call that mm-hmm. they have a relative or someone like that who's experiencing a mental break of some kind mm-hmm. or mental difficulty of some kind. So
that's actually not what I was thinking about, but that is a good one to bring up. I was thinking about the early response system.
Yes.
And the early response system is really kind of trying to track officers. One thing, again, that I think we aren't aware of is that because this is a job where people are going in every day and dealing with a lot of times the worst that you can mm-hmm. see in humanity. You're talking about, like the mayor had spoke about at the meeting, officers who have to go and question a woman who just smothered to death three of her children, who are at the scenes of horrific murders. There's PTSD. There mm-hmm. are problems, and these officers need help. And for so many decades, the mentality has been pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Yep. The department is starting to change
the military has that too. It's
exactly.
The old sort of macho model of you just suck it up and be a man.
Right. You know? And we've seen how devastating that is to military mm-hmm. members. It's devastating to first responders as well. Mm-hmm. And so in my opinion, more even than civilian oversight, that kind of early warning system to help officers is going to be the best thing that we can do to create a better system, because we are trying to find officers who need that additional help mm-hmm. and maybe should have some time off of the street to deal with what they're going through.
And if you're going to do that, it also has to be a way to do it without them without anybody attaching stigma
Correct.
To it, or else it won't happen.
Correct.
You know, exactly. Julie makes a great point. I agree 100% with that. I think that's one of the better things we've done. And I've always supported body cams. I think they're a good tool for de-escalating both the police response and the response of the civilians they're dealing with at that time.
And both sides. And I think is the part that people often miss is that does it constrain the police? Sure, they're aware of it, but probably constrain citizens even more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because you would hope in the vast majority of the citizens, it's far more likely that the citizen is misbehaving.
Yeah.
And just because, you know, you've got on the one side, you've got a trained, controlled entity, and the other side you have God knows what, and there's a lot of crazy people out there, and if you're really crazy, it isn't going to matter. But if you're somewhat aware that you're going to be observed, and it probably produces better behavior on both sides.
Yeah, statistically, and there are studies that show that absolutely it does. It produces better behavior on both sides for people to know that, look, those actions are going to be public. And, you know, I'm curious to see, as a side note, if it changes the rate of traffic tickets issued during traffic stops, because I think it changes behavior in lots of little subtle ways.
In which direction, though?
I think it's tougher for officers actually to let people go on mm-hmm. some infractions now. So we need to be aware that there are positives, but there are also some potential pitfalls. One of the things that lots of officers across the country do, and ours here do a lot of, is when you're dealing with someone who's made a mistake, maybe committed a minor crime, if they're cooperative, if they're being nice and polite and friendly, oops, you know, I shouldn't have done that, but I did. There's a lot of warnings issued in a lot of situations for things like that.
Well, I don't know if this is done, and I mentioned off air that, you know, I had experience as a police officer for a year in Baltimore a long time ago and work in a pretty tough neighborhood. And we were advised that letting people off the hook on minor traffic stuff was a good way to kind of build a little bit of community rapport. And so it was kind of said, so there's a place for that.
There's an important place for that. And I hope body cams don't interfere with it, because I think one of the things that drives a lot of the conversation is that almost any time a civilian has an interaction with an officer, it's negative for them, even if it's a minor thing like a traffic ticket.
My favorite story in that regard, I want to tell it just because it was funny. There was a guy who blew through a stop sign at a particular corner one day. I pulled him over, and I did the warning, and I did kind of what the norm was at the time, you know, warned him and let him go. And before I get to the rest of the story, I will tell you that my other observation was when you pulled people over some infraction, in 100% of the cases, they had some story about why they did it. I never had a case where they didn't. The next day, the same guy on the same corner did the same thing. And I'm walking over to his car, and I'm just waiting for it. I said, I'm just wondering what story he is going to have. I'm just waiting to hear this. And I'm ready to let him go again for the same norm. And he throws up his hands like, you got me. And so I had to write the ticket. And I remember that 40 years later.
Yes. I think Julie brought up, to get back to the main conversation real quick, I did want to touch on one point. The ability of police to police themselves, I think, is improving all the time through those technologies. And I think by critical oversight by the council and the city manager's office, the chief of police, I think they've taken pretty significant steps the last few years to increase transparency and accountability. The biggest concern that we have is very simple. The motion that was made when this passed by Councilwoman Laura Pastor was that the people in the room, meaning the Poder Puente activists, specifically be included on that police review board and committee.
And I can see how that would be terrifying. I've thought through from my standpoint, and I said, you know, I think I'm less concerned about which model it is than I would be what kind of person sits on that board. And I see groups of activists on both sides of this who would be just plain horrible.
Awful.
Yeah, because they come with nobody with an agenda, you know, somebody with the most open mind who's going to look at everything on a case-by-case basis with no preconception, and you go where the evidence takes you, and that's it.
Mike, that has been – if you – look at a lot of these civilian oversight boards. What differentiates the ones that have been successful or considered successful by communities versus the ones that haven't is its implementation. And even more than implementation, it's resources. Are you giving these separate, you know, independent auditor's office or investigations officers, are you giving them the kind of money that they need and the staff that they need to carry out their job effectively? And are you ensuring that the folks who are sitting on these boards are not coming in with some kind of a preordained political opinion on this? Because if you're not, then you're just going to have a board that falls apart and you're going to have an even bigger mess on your hands after the fact.
If you don't have the money to do the investigation, then all you have to rely on are your own pre-existing prejudices.
Right.
But even with the money, if the prejudices are there, all the money in the world won't solve that.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if it's someone on the right who's saying cops can do no wrong and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's someone on the left who's saying that they're racist pigs. I mean, either way, you're getting a decision by a fairly powerful institution that is skewed from anything that resembles the reality of the situation.
And the problem I see with trying to staff a board like that is that it's both groups that are agitating and want to be on. The moderate, show me the facts type person looks at a thing like that and say, that's the worst job in the world. I wouldn't want to be within 100 miles of that.
I
think that's correct. But I do think that there are people who would be willing to be on a board like that. And I hope that the council is incredibly deliberative and perhaps in this instance can come together and work on this in a much more united way versus how they handled this vote. I mean, I have to say, as a resident of the city of Phoenix and as somebody who is really interested in this, I was really disappointed with that council. I was incredibly disappointed. I didn't see an opportunity for them to come together. I didn't see them working together. I saw it as an us versus them situation.
We'll be back for final segment in the think tank on the issue of policing in Phoenix.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are final segment discussing policing in Phoenix, in particular the newly established civilian. Does it have a name?
Civilian Review Board at this point.
Generically,
yes.
it is a civilian review board. Sam, you're down in the weeds on this, working at the council. So what's the next step? Where do we go from here?
Well, the next step is the law department has to actually draft the ordinance to match what council just passed, and then that will have to come back in front of council for a vote of approval.
Does that mean that they could alter the model?
Absolutely. The model can.
So it was only passed conceptually?
It was passed in framework, essentially. But to change that framework, you can modify lots of things within your house, right? You can redecorate it all you want. But if you're actually going to go and change the walls and the roof or the, you know, add a garage onto the thing, then you have to actually go get the permit. So they would have to go back and redo a vote separately to do those things, send it back to law for reframing.
Think there's any chance of that?
No, I think they're going to, you know, look, I think the focus is going to be on implementation right now by a lot of folks. I think that's where obviously Councilman Garcia is going to be very, very focused for these next few months. And also, let's not forget, we're heading into an election cycle for half the Phoenix City Council, including the mayor.
Who's up and who isn't? Who's up? Who's up for re-election?
Councilwoman Guardado is up for re-election. Councilman Nowakowski is termed out. Mm-hmm. And Councilwoman Williams is also termed out. So both of those seats are up along with the mayor's seat.
Okay.
All of them are going to be a little focused outside the building.
Isn't the election is that elect 2020 or 21?
Yeah, so the way we do it now, you're going to have the open primary in November of 2020, and the runoff would be in March of 2021.
Okay, so the primary is coincident with the presidential
election.
That's
correct.
Okay. That's a change.
Yeah, it is a big change. And I think in a presidential year, that's going to be interesting.
It's tough to main focus on a mayoral or particularly a council race when you are facing a presidential.
That was
election.
A compromise, right. It would have been much better to do a standard August, November.
Right, especially in a competitive state like Arizona is right now.
And cannot stress that enough. I've looked at the figures nationally. They're not just competitive. There are five toss-up states in this country that will determine the next election as of this moment, and we're one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we have never – we are going to see – this is a good time, probably too late. The price has already gone up to buy media in Arizona. Media companies, I mean, because they're going to be flush with campaign money. I mean –
right.
All of the ads are going into five states.
It's going to be difficult to get your message across. I mean, not just because of the presidential race, the U.S. Senate race, and a whole bunch of initiatives. It's going to be
finding a piece of perceptual space left.
Right.
It may do on some of the initiatives that may help some of the folks who are doing a lot of door-to-door stuff because
grassroots is going to be key.
Because the media is going to be already overflooded with other messages.
Right.
Also, one thing we're seeing in this presidential race, I don't think a lot of these ballot initiatives are going to make it. Marijuana will make it because they have gathering through the dispensaries. But I think a lot of others, one of the things people are forgetting is the people who would go out and gather those signatures right now, and you need a ton of them to get on the ballot. I think Mike Bloomberg hired them all.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Red for Ed has the capacity.
Well, when they're turning out people these days, they're turning out 40 or 50. That's not enough for that kind of effort to do it on a volunteer basis.
Right.
There is a paid effort behind the Invest in Ed initiative as well. And so I do think that one's going to end up on the ballot.
But what was powerful with them before was the unpaid thing.
Right.
Because when they took those unpaid signatures to get them verified, they were like 98% good.
Right.
Somebody looked at that and said, yeah, you know what? They're teachers.
They
are detail oriented. Those paid ones are half of them are garbage.
Right. Volunteers are always do a better job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Julie, where do we go from here?
Whew, this is tough. This is where we do need some leadership from our council members. And I've got to be honest, I don't see it. Like I said earlier, I'm really disappointed in what I saw during that meeting. There was an opportunity for council members to come together and say, how do we know that we're looking at civilian oversight. We know that this is what the community wants. How do we work together to ensure that it's something that is more unifying than divisive? And I think they dropped the ball in that respect. And so I don't have a whole lot of hope that they're going to come together now in implementation, but they need to. They really need to. And if they don't, voters should just clear house on that council.
My concern is what comes out of the upcoming elections and the ones after that, because there's a national model for this, that once they pass civilian review board, if this is your issue, then it's things like bail reform, which is turning out to be a real mess in New York and California. It's something like California's Prop 47, which basically eliminated the enforcement of low-level offenses and has led to a massive increase in those types of particularly property and drug crimes and things like that, and bringing a lot of blight.
Let me ask a question about implementation. What's the process? Ultimately, there will be people named to this. By whom?
We don't know that yet.
Oh. I have a quick proposal in listening to this. It should be city council vote requiring at least 7 affirmative votes.
And Mike, I will take your proposal to the council because I think it's a pretty darn good idea.
I mean, in other words, that's what screens out anybody who's any activist or,
And there should be some guidelines to begin with, some vetting. And even in addition to that, whoever ends up sitting on that board, there should definitely be some training so that they have a better understanding of what an officer goes through.
If your Facebook avatar is Back the Blue or F the Police, I think we can keep you off that list.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Correct.
Well, and those are increasingly being used. You want to find out. Use it in jury selection, too. You want to find out where somebody's coming from. It's out there for a lot of folks.
It is.
Everyone pays attention now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Sam Stone, Julie Earfley, interesting conversation. We will be back on this topic, I'm sure, as this evolves and gets implemented. We'll return with another topic next
week. More fun to come.
Next week in the Think Tank.
The streets that lead them and sirens call them on.